This is Robert Lang continuing the interview with Emeritus Professor Tino Baglio, November 29th, 2005. Tino?
Yes, when I was hired by the University of Wisconsin, I was given two appointments, one as an assistant professor teaching courses in theater, and also as the director of the Wisconsin Center for Theater Research. The Wisconsin Center for Theater Research was an archive that was jointly sponsored by the Department of Speech, as it was then called, and the State Historical Society of Wisconsin. The center was an outgrowth of Fred Haberman's interest in expanding the research capability of the department. And when he was chair of the department, he used his influence to start the Wisconsin Center for Theater Research, which would enable the department to gather primary source materials on the history of theater and television and film, so that graduate students, faculty, students, and researchers in general could do research in those areas of the arts. The model for this was the Mass Communications History Center, which the State Historical Society and the Department of Journalism and Mass Communications formed in the early 1960s to gather materials, primary source materials, documenting the history of journalism in the United States. In order to contextualize this, these research centers, these archives that were being started at the university, reflected the growth of higher education in the United States during this time. Subject areas like theater, television, journalism were new arrivals, you might say, in academia. And during the 1960s, there was a huge amount of interest in these areas. So there was a need to create opportunities for researchers to do original research to expand areas of knowledge that had not been developed earlier. The Mass Communications History Center was very successful in its early years. And this, as I said, motivated Fred Haberman, who was chair of the speech department at that time, to do something analogous to support the areas of theater, television, and film. Now, I should say something about the center and how it operated to enable you to understand what I did. Essentially, what the center did, or what the center directors did before my arrival, was to send out letters of invitation to prominent people in the arts, primarily theater, but also in television, and to a lesser extent, originally, in film. These letters of invitation would invite the donors to establish collections at the center, which meant then that they might donate their papers, consisting of letters, correspondence, various drafts of plays, whatever, that might document their careers. In addition to sending out letters of invitation, the director would take field trips to either New York and to Los Angeles to talk to these people individually and try to convince them to, as I said, donate their materials to the university.
Tino, would these people be figures who had a tie to Wisconsin?
Not necessarily, but of course, the center went after people who did have ties, no question about it. But we also just went after people who had made reputations for themselves in the field. This was a period when few institutions throughout the United States actively collected materials to document the performing arts. Up until this point, the New York Public Library had been a natural repository for the history of the Broadway theater because of its, of course, location in New York. And all the curator had to do was to pick up the telephone and contact actors, directors, playwrights to donate their materials to the New York Public Library. And over the years, the New York Public Library became the major repository of materials documenting the history of the American theater. Subsequently, the collections of the New York Public Library were deposited at Lincoln Center when Lincoln Center opened in the late 1960s. But there were very few other institutions like the New York Public Library that had an active collecting policy during the 1960s, which gave Wisconsin a heads up. And during the first several years of the center's existence, prior to the time that I arrived, the center had been very lucky in collecting some very significant collections. One series of collections that come to mind most vividly are the collections documenting the work of Hollywood Tim, the screenwriters who were blacklisted by the House Un-American Activities Committee. Well, the center prior to my arrival had three directors in about 4 years. There was turmoil among the ranks, even though my predecessors did an excellent job in collecting materials for the center, their professional relationships with the department were sometimes strained for various reasons, or because they were offered jobs, better jobs elsewhere. But they left the university, and as a result of their departure, the future of the center was in doubt, because there was a great deal of, as I said, turnaround at the director's level.
Was Fred Haberman still supportive?
Yes, he was. And he offered me the position to be the director of the center. You must understand, at this point, I had just recently graduated from Indiana University. This was in 1966. I graduated from Indiana University at the age of 26 in 1964, so I was 28 years old when I began my tenure at the University of Wisconsin. In other words, I was very young and very inexperienced, having only taught for 2 years at Oberlin. I would like to think that Fred Haberman saw in me some talents for this, but whatever his motivation, he offered me that position. And I ran with it, I must say. I should indicate that the Department of Speech, its offices were dispersed around the university. It did not have, it had a central office in Bascom Hall, but the sub-areas of the departments had offices scattered all around. My first office was located at 2201 University Avenue, which today is located right across the street from the Octopus Car Wash. There were several offices located in that building, but the department used it primarily as a scene shop for the Compass Theater that was located in that building. Uh-huh. And during my first year or two at the university, I seldom made it on campus because my office was located a couple miles away. But anyway, that was my headquarters, and I began to work in earnest to try to revive the center. So, even though I had a half-time position, which I should point out that being the director of the center was a half-time appointment, which meant that I taught on a half-time basis in addition to that, which typically meant that I would teach one course a semester. Uh-huh. And my first years here, I taught a course on the history of drama from the Greeks to the present day. This would be a two-semester course that I taught. And then I also taught a course on the modern American theater when Jonathan Kirwan was on leave. But that was a very interesting series of courses that I taught. I also taught courses in theater history during my first years teaching here, in addition to graduate seminars on occasion. But basically my area of research was the history of the American theater.
This is side two of tape two of the ongoing interview with Emeritus Professor Tino Baglio.
As I said, I spent most of my time trying to collect research materials for the center. I should give you some background here. We had a separate budget for the center at this time, and I remember what the budget was very vividly. It was $10,000 a year. And with $10,000, we were able to devote about $2,000 to $3,000 of that, which would pay for between 4 and 5 1-week long field trips to New York and Los Angeles. That's how far a dollar went back then.
Wow.
I could spend a whole week in Los Angeles, a whole week in New York, and the amount that we spent was negligible compared to what it would cost today. I say this because the center's budget was ample at the time to do the work that we needed to do, taking field trips, paying for the shipping of the materials from wherever to the university, and to pay for the cataloging and organizing of these collections once they got here.
Tino, did the budget come from the university or the society?
The budget came mainly from LMS.
Uh-huh.
The State Historical Society's contribution to the center was providing a physical home uh-huh. to house the collections and to provide research services at the State Historical Society. In addition, the State Historical Society provided some partial funding for shipping and for cataloging as well. But the bulk of the budget came from the College of Letters and Science. I say this because over the course of time, the center's budget did not increase. But of course, inflation did. And inflation took a heavy toll on the center because it eroded the center's ability to carry on its work. But at the time, the funding was ample and allowed me to collect a lot of materials for the center.
Do you know, are there any collections that you were instrumental in securing that you're particularly proud of?
Well, the major collection that put the center really on the map was the United Artists collection.
Mm-hmm.
And I should say that this was a serendipitous event because I did not set out to collect the United Artists collection, or I should say I did not set out to acquire the United Artists collection. In order to gain entree to people's offices, I typically said to them in my letter, a friend of yours has already donated a collection to the University of Wisconsin, and your friend has recommended that you might be a potential candidate to establish a collection because of your reputation and so on and so forth. Because if I just sent a letter to a person cold, I would not always receive a response. So I had to devise ways to gain entree. I sent a letter to Arthur Krim, who was the CEO, the president and CEO of United Artists Corporation, because a friend of his, Ruth Goodman Goetz, had established a collection at the University of Wisconsin. She was a playwright famous for the play that she wrote called The Heiress. Well, in any event, I sent a letter to Arthur Krim saying that Ruth Goodman Goetz had recommended him as a potential candidate to establish a collection. And he answered my letter and invited me to his office when I was in New York. And he asked me, what would you like? Well, I went for the juggler, so to speak, and I said, well, I would like for United Artists Corporation to establish a collection at the university. Now, I have to contextualize this to make the acquisition of the United Artists collection understandable. We're now talking about the end of the 1960s, about 1968. At this time, the American Film Institute had already been founded, And one of the goals of the American Film Institute was to convince Hollywood studios to preserve their heritage. During the 1960s, students began to study film seriously. Film became a serious object of study on the part of students and researchers. Film, for the first time in its history, was considered to be a significant art form. And in realization of this, the American Film Institute wanted to convince Hollywood to save and preserve its heritage. By that, the AFI meant that it wanted to convince the studios to preserve their old films from decomposition and decay, and it wanted to convince the studios to preserve their business records and other things. The American Film Institute's goal was buttressed by the Library of Congress, because the Library of Congress worked with the American Film Institute during this time, and in a sense became the repository for the films that the film studios would save and preserve. The Library of Congress had gotten into this earlier because prior to this time, when a studio wished to copyright a motion picture, would have to send a copy of the film to the Library of Congress in order to receive copyright protection. But the studios were not always regular in filing copyright copies of films, but when the American Film Institute was formed, there was a more concerted effort to be concerned about this. Now, you must understand, this was the era before ancillary markets. This was the era before home video. This is the era before CDs. At the time, studios did not really think that their old films had any residual value. And as a result of this, there was no economic pressure for the studios to preserve their old films. Yes, they could show them on television at the time, but the amount of money they could get from an old film to show on television was not enough to convince the companies to really preserve their old films. And you must understand that up until 1948, feature films were printed on what was called a nitrate film stock, which will decompose over time unless it was stored under ideal conditions. Because nitrate film stock is an unstable film stock, many films had decomposed beyond recognition over time prior to 1948. After 1948, films were being printed on an acetate film stock, which was more stable. But there are all kinds of problems of preservation, particularly when it comes to color films and so forth. So it's not just a matter of preserving an old film, it's preserving old films in a very sophisticated way so that either they don't decompose or to prevent them from their colors being faded. In any event, the American Film Institute's major goal at this point was to convince the studios to preserve their artistic heritage. Okay. Now, this is a long-winded explanation as to how I was able to acquire the United Artists collection. So that when I went into Arthur Quinn's office and I asked him to establish a collection of United Artists materials, it was not done in a vacuum because he too understood what the goals of the American Film Institute were at the time, because he was a member of a major motion picture company, and his company supported the American Film Institute. So a lot of my background spade work had been done. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to start from ground zero. Now, as it happened, United Artists was about to discard its business records prior to 1951. The present management of the company, or the then present management of the company headed by Arthur Krim, took over United Artists in 1951 and saved the company from near bankruptcy. The company was formed in 1919 by Mary Pickford, Douglas Fairbanks, D.W. Griffith, and Charlie Chaplin. They ran it from 1919 to about 1950. The company had almost gone out of business after World War II for various reasons. And a new management team headed by Arthur Krim saved the company from extinction. But essentially, the company before 1951 was a totally different operation and had no real connection with the company that Arthur Krim revived beginning in 1951. So the company that I visited in the late 1960s had no use for its old business records, which were being stored in an old dusty warehouse on Long Island. As a matter of fact, it was very costly for them to house these papers, and they were about to destroy them, as a matter of fact. So when I got there and asked for a UA collection, they thought about these business records and thought that they might be the core of whatever donation they wished to make. Now, I had to spend a considerable amount of time to convince them that these materials had research value. Ms. Innocence was at the very beginning of modern film scholarship and research, mm-hmm. when you actually had to convince people in the film industry that the work they were doing as filmmakers had artistic consequences or cultural value. Mm-hmm. And particularly, I had to be persuasive in convincing them that business records, as opposed to the films themselves, had research value. But they were also concerned, too, about how these materials would be used. They didn't want to just give them give us the materials and allow any person off the streets to come in and exploit them in some way or another. So I had to over a course of a year at least, I had to convince them that these materials were of research value, that we had a serious interest in acquiring them. After having acquired the materials, we would take care of them. They would be housed appropriately in a research setting and so forth, so they could feel that their gift was given to an institution that had integrity, an institution that they could trust. Now, they just didn't take my word for this because they sent out some executives to the university on several occasions to look around, to talk to the faculty, and so forth, to make certain that what I said was actually true. But I did gain their faith, and they said that they would be happy to donate the business records to the University of Wisconsin. So that was the beginning of a major gift, and I spent a considerable amount of time one summer just going through the entire collection with Jack Jallings, who was an archivist at the State Historical Society, identifying materials that we wanted to ship back to Madison. The warehouse...
Oh, this is out in Long Island.
Yes, here. Right. Yes, this was out in Long Island. And you must understand that we couldn't accept everything because it would have filled up the entire State Historical Society. And the vast majority of the business records were of no value to anybody. So we had to identify and isolate the key items in the collection. As it was, we brought back a whole truckload full of materials that we ultimately cataloged and organized. Well, on the basis of this, United Artists decided to increase its gift. And this was one of the most exciting years of my life, perhaps the most exciting year of my life as an academic, because over a course of several months, I would get telephone calls asking me if he would like to accept additional materials.
And what year is this?
All of this peaked between 1968 and 1970.
Okay.
We're talking now about a 14 or 15 month window, you might say. So after deciding to give us the corporate records, they decided to give us additional materials. The United Artists Corporation had purchased the Warner Brothers Film Library, which consisted of everything that Warner Brothers produced in the sound era from 1930 to about 1950. There was a period during the 1950s when Hollywood studios sold off their old film libraries to television syndicators because the studios felt that these old films had very little residual value, and during the 1950s, the studios were trying to recover from a recession created by the advent of television. Mm-hmm. So in order to raise money, several studios sold off their pre-1948 film libraries to new companies that syndicated the sales of these films to television, either on prime time or off-peak times mm-hmm. throughout the day. United Artists acquired two such film libraries, the Warner Brothers Film Library and the RKO Film Library. Uh-huh. And they in turn donated copies of these films to the University of Wisconsin as part of their gift. They decided to give us 16 millimeter prints of everything that they owned. Simultaneously, they were going to give to the Library of Congress through the American Film Institute the original 35 millimeter negatives of these films for preservation purposes. So the gift. In other words, the gift that United Artists gave to the Wisconsin Center for Theater Research was a two-pronged gift, one part of which went to the Library of Congress.
I see.
Because we were not in the position to preserve original 35 millimeter negatives. We just did not have the preservation facilities, nor did we have the money to do this. Mm-hmm. And what we wanted were 16 millimeter prints that researchers could use to conduct ongoing research. Okay. Well, the long and short of it is, we received, in addition to the corporate records, the Warner Brothers film library, which not only consisted of 16 millimeter prints, but the screenplays, the original screenplays that were used, the legal files, thousands of still of publicity stills and other research materials. We didn't receive the production records, you must understand, but we received screenplays, stills, and other materials. So the gift that they ultimately gave us established the center within a very short period of time as one of the major archives in the country for the study of film research.
Tino, it is such an extraordinary accomplishment of yours.
Yes, it was.
I mean, it really is.
Yeah.
You did it.
Yes. But I received plenty of support from the university. I can recall once when two of the vice presidents from UA were here on campus. By then, my office had moved from 2201 University Avenue to the 11th floor of Van Nuys. And we used one of the seminar rooms near the Board of Regents floors to conduct our negotiations. I remember that Fred Harvey Harrington came down to shake hands with the UA vice presidents to encourage them and to tell them that the whole university is behind this acquisition. So I did get plenty of support from people in the administration at the time.
That's good.
So, and I was very happy that I received this this support. So I must say that a prime motivation for United Artists to do this was to receive a significant tax write-off. Uh-huh. The late 1960s were bad years for most of the major motion picture companies. They were undergoing another recession, experiencing another recession. And many companies lost millions of dollars in between 1969 and 1971. So I suppose this was another motivation for United Artists to make this donation, because they would enjoy a tax write-off in the process. But in other words, it was fine with me, and this was totally legal at the time, and this was a major factor in convincing institutions around the country to donate research materials to research institutions. I mean, this was an element of government policy that changed dramatically in the early 1970s. The government abolished the so-called loophole that allowed companies to do this. But while it was there in place, it enabled the center to acquire a huge amount of materials of significance, of research significance.
Tino, from that point forward, is it fair to say that actually Madison and the Center for Film and Theater Research and the University of Wisconsin is one of the top two or three centers for film research?
Absolutely. At the time, we were. I mean, and I could identify the major research institutions at that time. Because we had been so successful in acquiring the UA collection, we motivated other institutions to do likewise. First of all, the New York Public Library realized that it couldn't just play a passive role in collecting theater materials. They became more aggressive in trying to collect Broadway materials. Institutions like the University of Southern California and UCLA began to increase their efforts to collect film materials. And of course, they ultimately would have much more leverage just by virtue of their proximity to Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Other institutions like Boston University began to collect materials in film, television, and theater as well. So by the 1970s, there must have been, as well as the University of Texas, they began to actively collect materials, so that there must have been at least a half a dozen universities and libraries throughout the country that had acquired significant materials documenting the history of film, television, and theater. Ultimately, the center stagnated in comparison to these other institutions for different reasons. And the main reason, of course, was they had more money. Our budget remained constant. It was fixed, and it was eroded by inflation. And the 70s were a difficult period for the university. No one's budgets increased, and we were unable to increase our budgets to keep up with the times. But nonetheless, we remained a significant archive, even though we were not able to continue with our collecting efforts at the same level of intensity as we did in the late 1960s. Moreover, we had almost run out of space. The State Historical Society had constructed a new wing to its original building, and with the United Artists Collection and the other things we collected, or I collected, I guess you might say, we practically filled up all the existing space at the State Historical Society. So space became a problem during the 1970s as well. How much more could we afford to collect? And you must understand that when you collect it, when you receive a collection, it's not just a matter of putting the materials in a box and putting them in storage. You have to organize them, accession them, create inventories, and expend a considerable amount of effort to make the materials available for research. This is onerous work. It takes skills, the skills of an archivist to do it properly, and this is an expense. Mm-hmm. And when the university experienced its financial plight of the 1970s, it began to either cut back or just to maintain at present levels its support of research institutions like the center. And this was too bad. But in a sense, it reflected the Wisconsin way. One of the virtues of the university was the fact that it allowed researchers or academics like myself to become entrepreneurs, to take advantage of opportunities as they arose. Now, opportunities are not always present, and they come and go, mm-hmm. but on various occasions, entrepreneurial faculty could accomplish things like this. Anyway, one of the offshoots of my acquiring the United Artists Collection was my promise that I would write a history of United Artists. That was one of the tools of persuasion that I used, so to speak, to get them to understand that I had a serious interest in acquiring the UA corporate records. Well, long and short of it is, I published a history of United Artists Corporation.
What year?
Yeah, in 1975.
Okay.
United Artists gave me a research grant in addition to giving the centers a grant to catalog the materials. And I was able to devote a couple of years to writing the history of United Artists from 1919 to 1950. I had also received a grant from the Louis B. Mayer Foundation, which was connected with the American Film Institute, that enabled me to finish writing the book.
This is the book, United Artists, the Company Built by the Stars.
That's correct, yes.
Now, there were some unintended consequences of that, weren't there?
Yes, absolutely. One of the things is that my research interests changed. I had started out at the University of Wisconsin teaching courses in theater history and dramatic literature. As a result of acquiring the UA collection, I became a film historian. And my research interests changed dramatically. And from around 1971 or 72 on, my research interests focused exclusively on film, and it has remained there since that time. My interest in United Artists Corporation as a business was not necessarily a new thing for me, because when I was first director of the center, I was interested in the collections the center had from Broadway producers, David Merrick in particular. And in the 1960s, there was a new interest in the performing arts, and there was a new interest in trying to understand the economics of the performing arts. not necessarily in New York City, but also the performing arts as they existed throughout the country. Foundations like the Ford Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, and others tried to do studies to make people understand the special economic problems confronting the performing arts. And there was a book published by two Princeton economists, Bomall and Bowen, called The Performing Arts, The Economic Dilemma, which articulated the special economic issues confronting the arts. All this, you know, was taking place in the late 1960s when the Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts was being constructed, when there were similar institutions like this being contemplated throughout the country, when there was a great deal of interest in, you might say, decentralizing America's cultural scene to enable cities around the country to have performing arts centers. Mm-hmm. So the long and short of it is I became interested in the economics of the theater by virtue of the fact that we had these special collections here at the University of Wisconsin that enabled us to study firsthand the documents of a Broadway producer and to begin to participate in this surge of research documenting performing arts economics in the United States. So in a way, I was sort of primed to do something like a business history of United Artists. Uh-huh. Now, as it turned out, I did not write a business history of UA per se, because my skills as an economic historian or a business historian were not that great at the time. But also, I was mostly interested in the dynamics of the owners who are major motion picture stars, and this was the only company in the history of modern Hollywood that was run by motion picture stars. So my interest was, how did Mary Pickford and Charlie Chaplin run the company? Mm-hmm. And how did they interact with their partners who were big Hollywood producers? So that was the part of the company that I was most interested in and what I studied for my book. Subsequently, I did another history of United Artists Corporation, a continuation or volume two, if you will, from 1951 to 1978, where I do try to analyze the operations of a modern business corporation. But that came a little bit later.
Which was the one that Walter Mirisch? You and Walter had some difference of opinion, didn't
you? That is correct, yes. This was my second volume.
Okay.
The Mirisch Corporation played a major role in United Artists' history during the late 60s and 70s, and the Mirisch Corporation contributed many films to the company that I can discuss later on. And Walter and I had differences of opinion as to just how successful some of the films were. I must admit that if Walter had been as forthcoming with me in recent years as he was back then when I first interviewed him, maybe I would have been able to reconstruct the history more accurately.
I think it's important for the record to note that Walter Mirisch is an alum of the University
That's
of
Wisconsin. That's correct, yes.
So
the interview will now continue on tape number three. This is tape number three, side one, of the oral history interview with Emeritus Professor of Communication Arts, Tino Baglio, also Emeritus Director of the Arts Institute. Tino, you were talking about the Center for Film and Theater Research.
Yes, as I pointed out, the acquisition of the United Artists Collection was really the high point of the center that made it truly an international resource for the study of film. And I must say that after we acquired the collection, researchers from around the world literally came to Wisconsin to do research. Mm-hmm. Because at the time, the ability to study film history in depth just was not possible in most countries because the materials were not available. Now ultimately, with the creation of ancillary markets, with the advent of home video and so forth, more and more films became available for scholarly study. But the period before that made the resources of the center very valuable for historical research. And at the time, too, the scholars were interested in the history of Hollywood, because Hollywood, of course, throughout its history, was the dominant film industry in the world, and people from around the world wanted to study its operations. So we contributed a lot, I think, to the development of film research by virtue of having the UA collection. Of course, scholars were also going to the Library of Congress to do research as well. But as I said, our budget was frozen, and you can just see that with each passing year as a result of inflation, higher transportation costs, higher costs of hotels and things like this, our ability to continue was diminished. Moreover, beginning in 1970, Congress rescinded or closed the so-called loophole that allowed people to take tax deductions based upon the fair market value of materials yes. donated to a research institution. Exceptions were made to works of art, like paintings and sculpture and so forth, but these exceptions did not pertain to business records, films, the things that we would have collected or wanted to collect through the center. So this had a significant impact on our collecting ability, which did not mean necessarily that we were unable to acquire collections. We were still able to do so, but the economic incentive for making a tax write-off, for receiving a tax write-off, was gone after 1970. Also, over this period of time, because, I hate to use the word, the center was stagnating, it wasn't really quite stagnating, it became something different. When I became director of the center was just getting off the ground. I enjoyed the entrepreneurial opportunities it provided, and I really found that to be really quite exciting. But once it became institutionalized, so to speak, and continued just as a research center and archive functioning on a regular basis, day in and day out, I began to lose interest ultimately. I enjoy the challenge of creating things, but I am not a bureaucrat. I don't like to sit behind a desk and to see things through it in the same way, day in and day out. Our opportunities to be creative with the center were diminished because we didn't have the funds to do anything except just to sustain it, you know, on a regular basis. And we were not able to expand the staff to do different things. We had little money to be innovative in terms of programming and so forth. So over a course of, say, 8-10 years, my interest in being the director of the center diminished.
Tino, the unavailability of money, was that primarily a function of the lack of money for the university generally, or were the various deans of LNS becoming less interested in the center?
Yeah, well, clearly our ability to sustain our operations appropriately was a reflection of the economic state of the university. I mean, as everyone knows, the 70s were a bad time for higher education, and after the 1970s, or after 1970, the state legislature has not been very generous in its appropriations to the university. And because LMS's budget is directly connected to instruction, the money that it has available for ancillary operations to support a film archive, you know, the pressures to focus, to funnel all your money to instruction were so great, so there wasn't that much money left over to increase our budget. Uh-huh. And this was an unintended consequence, because the center was a creation of the 60s, when higher education was booming in the United States, when literally LNS couldn't spend all the money that it received in any given year, and it was looking for opportunities to create things like the center, to increase research opportunities, to expand instruction and what have you. Back in the 1960s, foundations, particularly the Ford Foundation, gave the university many millions of dollars to speed up the whole process of creating PhDs to meet the demand of higher education. Well, the 60s were great. The 70s, there was a period of recession in higher education. The boom was over. Budgets were constricting. And of course, that affected LMS's ability to support the center. Now, I also think that the lack of support, or the lack of any increase in our funding was a reflection also on the part of some of the deans who administered LMS during this time. It's hard to really ascribe motives, but there was, you might say, a diminishing enthusiasm on the part of LMS administration to support the center during the 1970s. One of the disheartening things I experienced after I acquired the UA collection was I had expected that the university would give us additional funding to hire on a permanent basis a film archivist and a manuscripts archivist to oversee the collection.
Right.
We were successful in getting a film archivist hired, but we were never successful in getting or hiring a manuscripts archivist or additional support staff to really support this collection and to work with researchers and so on. And I was told by Fred Haberman that Chancellor Young was very impressed with the fact that we had gotten the UA collection, and said that if I were to succeed in getting MGM to donate its collection to the university, that he would make a special effort to try to raise outside funds for us. Well, to try to walk on water twice is very difficult, you know. and the thought that I could get the UA collection was, you know, even if I tried, I'm not sure that I could, because another thing was happening after 1970. I had mentioned the tax laws changing. I had mentioned the fact that the university was in financial straits. But thirdly, other institutions began to, as I indicated earlier, other institutions, primarily USC and UCLA, began to, they woke up and they began to aggressively collect materials.
Mm-hmm.
Same things that we were going after. But because they were located, you know, in Los Angeles, a phone call away from studios and executives, they could maintain close personal and professional ties with key leaders in the industry. My ability to go to Los Angeles and to make similar contacts and to create similar associations were diminished because our travel budgets were being constricted. And in order to maintain professional contact, you have to be there a lot, and you have to spend a lot of time with these people. And of course, that was impossible, difficult, if not impossible to do from Madison. So we were facing more competition during the 1970s as well for collections, particularly the University of Texas Library, the Howlett Zella Library, provided a lot of competition. They were able to purchase collections. They had enough money from their oil sales and so forth, and so they were actually able to purchase collections. The same was true with Boston University. So after we demonstrated to the world that we could collect materials, other institutions with more financial resources became more competitive.
So you never seriously attempted anything with MGM?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No, I didn't. I shouldn't put it this way. Of course, I sent out letters to everybody. I mean, but the thought that the MGM would donate a similar collection to the University of Wisconsin just was not realistic.
Uh-huh.
At this point. And I should say that we were constrained from acquiring large collections by this point as well, because as I said earlier, the State Historical Society had run out of space.
Mm-hmm.
And storage became a real issue, and still is a real issue for the State Historical Society, because Libraries and archives are very expensive operations because you need temperature and humidity controlled spaces, and the materials just are not used that often, that much, to justify a huge amount of capital infusion or expenditures. So it's very difficult and very expensive for state historical societies and libraries to house books and manuscripts. And that was another factor that prevented us from being entrepreneurial or to expand. But we were successful. I mean, as I said, throughout the 1970s, researchers would be coming from all around to do research. But I was losing interest in the center because, as I said, I had done my thing, and just to sustain it on a day-to-day basis was not appealing to me because I was looking for new or different opportunities.
Tino, give us your assessment of where the center is today and what you see its future as.
You know, the center still has a lot of resources, and one of the virtues of the history of the center was the fact that people who replaced me brought different energies, you might say, different interests and different levels of energy to the center, reflecting the interests of the directors. For example, David Bordwell was the director of the center, not directly after me, but a few years after I stepped down. And David became very interested in Hong Kong cinema as a research interest. And he became interested in actually acquiring 35 millimeter prints. Now, by the time he became director of the center, the film industry had changed dramatically. This was a period when home video came into existence, when films by the thousands became available to any consumer who wanted to rent a tape or to buy a tape. And this also meant that studios were no longer interested in, well, put it this way, the so-called studios were less interested in protecting their 35 millimeter prints. Up until the time of home video, studios kept close tabs on where their prints were because they did not wish for them to be taken over by other people to exploit in some way or another. But with the advent of home video, this meant that films lost some of their unique qualities, if you will, and they became more ubiquitous. So studios were more amenable now to getting rid of used 35 millimeter prints. In any event, what I'm saying is that David knew this, of course, and because of his interest in Hong Kong cinema, and also because home video was killing off the 16 millimeter non-theatrical market, David was able to use this information to acquire additional prints for the center's archive. I should explain something. Throughout the 1970s, before the advent of home video, there was a non-theatrical film market in the United States. By this I mean there were any number of companies, including subsidiaries of major companies, that rented 16 millimeter prints to colleges and universities for classroom instruction or to other organizations for whatever purpose. But with the advent of home video, the 16 millimeter ancillary market died.
Oh, sure.
Because instead of showing 16 millimeter films in classes, professors began to show videos of these same films. Videos were handier, they were easier to use, and so forth. So this change that took place within the industry, the death of the demise of the 16 millimeter non-theatrical market, provided opportunities for archives because David was able to convince some companies to just give us 35 or 16 millimeter prints of films. So he, in his own way, even though he was not able to acquire manuscript collections in the same way that I was able to use his savvy to get films that would be of use to the department and to research. He encountered, I must say, significant resistance from the State Historical Society because the State Historical Society, well, where are you going to house these films? Because the State Historical Society's film vault, which is located underneath the front of the building, had always suffered from water leakage. It was an expensive facility to maintain because of humidity problems, and it was full. So when David said he wanted to acquire more films, where are you going to store these things? Well, ultimately, we're able to store some of these films in a university warehouse near where the Cole Center is. Oh. But housing or storage became a real problem for the center throughout its history, and it still is. But as I said, David made his own contribution. Over the course of time, the center had acquired many collections documenting radio. Now, radio as an object of study was never very hot in academia until recent years. The major focus of interest in the media was on film first, because film had a cachet associated with it. Mm-hmm. And then eventually television became an object of scholarly inquiry. Television never had the cachet that film had, but scholars were interested in it because it was more of a reflection of mass taste and so forth and so on. But over the course of our collecting, we would get materials documenting early radio history. Well, as it happens, the current director of the center, Michelle Hilmes, sort of, not on her own, but was one of the few scholars in recent years to resurrect interest in radio as an academic study. And because of her interest in this, she was able to highlight, you might say, the special qualities, if you will, of our radio collections. So I guess what I'm saying is that research tastes change over time, industry conditions change over time, the directors of the center change and bring, when they assume their roles, they bring their research interests to bear on the center. And the center has enough collections and enough range of materials to provide creative people with many opportunities, either for research or for publicity in terms of trying to promote research to your field, to people in your field and what have you. So, even though the center's budget doesn't allow the director to do much these days, you can still be creative and emphasize some of the research strengths of the collections.
Are you doing anything with the center these days?
Well, I was interim director of the center for a few years when I was chair of the department, because the State Historical Society wanted to institutionalize its relationship to the university, or actually, they wanted to institutionalize its relationship to the center and to the department. This was a reflection of a new change, administrative change at the State Historical Society. You might say, up until the 1990s, the relationship of the center to the State Historical Society was just understood. There wasn't a document. This was just the way it was. It was done on a handshake, you might say, and this was the way we operated. But the new administration of the State Historical Society wanted a more formal relationship whereby the staff of the center that was being funded by LMS, but working in the State Historical Society would be regularized. And we spent some time, as I say, working on a document that regularized the relationship of the center to the State Historical Society. Not that it changed anything, but nonetheless, because of my prior experience with the center, and because I was also chair of the department, I took on this added responsibility to make sure that this transition took place appropriately. Because I was the only one around with any sort of institutional history who we actually remembered the actual relationship between the center and the society before this period.
Tino, I'm certainly interested in the issue of securing private money for the center. That never really succeeded, did it?
No, it didn't. And as you know better than I do, in order to do this, I mean, it would take a real concerted effort to do this. But I must say that there were at least two reasons why we were unsuccessful in getting private funding for the center. The first was that up until 1970, potential donors wanted something from us, namely a tax write-off.
Yeah.
And in order to turn this around and to convince them to give us a donation, it would take some doing. But also, I have found, and it's hard to document, but my anecdotal experience, if you will, has been that people in the entertainment industry have not been generous in supporting research of their own business. Many of these people are quite generous in giving to medical research, but it's been very difficult, I found, to get them to donate money to do historical research or critical research, whatever, on their own field. Some of the very prominent people in the entertainment industry have given millions of dollars for medical research,
yeah.
But they haven't established any significant research grants for the study of film history.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I'm just hypothesizing, but I think that much of it has to do with just the culture, the Jewish culture, of people wanting to support this type of humanistic, not humanistic, but scientific research for the betterment of mankind. I also think that maybe many people working in the entertainment industry don't take their work that seriously, or understand the cultural significance of what they're doing. I mean, you know, I don't know how else to explain it. But also, at the same time, we didn't have the institutional support here at the university from the University of Wisconsin Foundation to make a concerted effort to raise money for the center. I think that, it's hard to say why this support never came. I think it's because of this anomalous position of the center. We were part LMS, part State Historical Society.
Yes.
So which institution is going to take the lead in doing fundraising? Within the department, the center, in a sense, had to compete for existing funds because the department had its own needs, instructional needs and research needs. The center was just one component of the department within LMS, within the university structure. It did not have its own separate identity or separate. It was a hybrid,
yeah.
at the university, and it's hard to raise money
for a hybrid.
That's right.
It's really true.
Tino, I'd like to segue now into your assessment of the Department of Communication Arts mm-hmm. and the other half or a portion
right.
of your life,
yes. Yes.
Because that was certainly your home, and you were a very prominent and very involved member of the department.
Right. Well, the speech department, as it was originally called, was an umbrella department that became the home of new academic disciplines during the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And at the time that I arrived at the university, it housed theater and drama, communicative disorders, radio, television, and film, and communication theory. There were historical reasons why these subject areas evolved the way they did and why they became comfortable under this umbrella historically. But beginning in the 1970s, the speech field began to fragment. Just about the time that I arrived there, communicative disorders broke off to form its own separate department, primarily because the communicative disorders is really far afield from the other courses and subject areas of speech, which are basically in the humanities, communicative disorders was more allied to the medical field than it was to the humanistic fields of rhetoric and television and so forth. So they broke off to form their own separate department to meet the needs of their clients, the people who were suffering from speech disorders and so on and so forth. So that was the first thing. But shortly after I arrived as well, there was an impetus to form a separate theater and drama department. This was taking place nationally during the late 60s and early 70s. Speech departments were breaking up. There was a real pressure from professors in theater and drama to form their own separate departments, to create, in other words, to create their own separate academic identities. Because when you're submerged within an umbrella department, you are just a wing of the larger department. You don't have your sense of separate identity, nor can you, in a sense, have any control over how you are going to evolve as a department. So there was tremendous pressure to form a separate theater and drama department by the faculty. And as I said, this reflected national trends. And when theater and drama, or when the department moved to its present facilities in Vilas Hall, it was at this time that theater and drama succeeded in breaking away from the department to form its own separate department.
Did you think that was a good development?
I was in favor of it initially. As a matter of fact, I was chair of the theater and drama division in the department. And I certainly agreed with my colleagues philosophically that theater and drama should be its own separate operation. But I disagreed with, I decided to remain in communication arts, as the speech department was then called, when it moved into Vilas Hall, for two reasons. First was my research interests had changed by then. I was doing film research. Secondly, I had significant personal and philosophical disagreements with some of my colleagues in theater. And they were, there's too much infighting, too much conflict, and I decided that I didn't. I thought that the Department of Communication Arts was more stable. I thought this would be a better place for me. A thing that really changed my attitude towards the theater and drama department was when we had an opportunity to hire Alan Schneider, a very prominent UW alum, a very prominent Broadway director, who directed Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf on Broadway and other plays, to become director of the University Theater. And my colleagues in theater and drama voted against this. And I just assumed that they voted against this is because he would have provided too much competition. So I saw what I considered to be some very mediocre people voting down an opportunity to bring him here as the director of the theater. This occurred before the break, of course. And this is what made me think that I don't want to continue my professional relationship with these people. I never really, in a sense, forgave them for this. And they decided to hire instead an academic who went down in flames within a year or two and created, to me, irrevocable harm to their program. I was very fortunate in being able to have a new academic discipline to repair to, and an academic home to repair to, and to allow theater and drama to go a separate way.
Tino, that's interesting what you say, based on my experience in the 90s at the UW Foundation. The theater department, and I didn't realize it went back this far, was generally regarded as inadequate and consistently engaged in internecine warfare.
Right, right, right.
So I take it from what you're saying that had a long
if inglorious, but long history.
Right, right. And there are divisions within certain departments. Typically, the division is between practitioners and academics. In the theater department, for example, there are the people who produce. These are the professors of act.
This is side two of tape three, November 29th, 2005, Emeritus Professor Tino Baglio.
As I say that, in departments like theater and drama, by virtue of the name, department name, there are the people who produce theater, and there are the faculty in the department that are academics who study theater history and study the history of drama. And are, you know, this is a natural division within a department, and because there are, in a sense, two types of people functioning within an academic department, there always is the possibility of having conflict for resources, for formulating an appropriate goal for a department, because there are different interests. And it doesn't necessarily have to result in internecine warfare, but the mere fact that there are these two types of academics functioning within an academic department can be a source of conflict. And as it happened in theater and drama, the leader, in my opinion, the leadership did not over the years to not calm the waters. And I have never regretted the fact that I made my decision to concentrate on film. And I don't know if I could have actually continued with my research interest in film had I gone to theater and drama, so maybe the decision was moot. Maybe I would have had to stay in communication arts if I wanted to become a film historian.
And Tino, this is happening in the early 70s?
Yes, about 1973 or thereabouts.
Okay. And so at that point, your new home becomes communication
right.
arts.
Right, yes.
And you have very little to do with theater and drama anymore.
That is correct, yes, right.
So let's take you from your tenure starting in 73 in communication arts, mm-hmm. your assessment of how the department developed, what you were teaching.
Yes.
Issues in the department.
Yes. Well, throughout the 1970s, I concentrated primarily on my own research. In 1975, I published my United Artists book. In 1976, I published an anthology, a collection of works that I called the American Film Industry. This was published, I should say both books were published by the University of Wisconsin Press. The American Film Industry book was really an important book in the history of the field, because by the middle 1970s, film studies throughout the country was expanding. And a lot of new people came into the field to do research and to teach. Because it was a young discipline, there wasn't a body of knowledge available, useful knowledge available to tap into if you were a professor. So in order to create a field, you had to do research and to publish. So there was a tremendous amount of stuff being published in the 1970s. My book has been identified as one of the top 100 books in film scholarship because it was instrumental in describing the operations of Hollywood from the very beginning to the present day in a way that was understandable to humanists who were going into film studies. And the book, I think, sold 12,000 copies, which was not a big deal today, but it was a big deal back
then.
That
was huge.
Because it became, you might say, a book that people refer to. And I've been told that as a result of this book, plus the work of other people as well, a little misunderstanding, that people going into film studies began to study the film industry. And to contextualize this a little bit, when people go into English literature, they don't necessarily study the publishing industry.
Uh-huh.
They study the literature. But I think I was instrumental in steering film studies, which is being populated by former English professors or former television professors or former language professors, and of helping to structure the field in such a way that the study of Hollywood as industry would be an integral part of the profession.
So a second seminal contribution. First was the center, and then second is this book.
The combination of my United Artists book and the American Film Industry book coming out in the middle 70s, I think, was important for the field and for myself as an academic.
Tino, at what point along here did you receive, or have you yet received, tenure?
Oh, I had received tenure early on. I came to the University of Wisconsin when I was 26. And by the time I was 35, I was a full professor. So I had gotten tenure within 4 years after my arrival.
Was it difficult?
No. Mm-hmm. No, I had already published a book. And it was much easier back then to get tenure than it is today, although I had a book and other things. But back then, getting tenure, because the university was expanding so greatly, you know, this was it made it easier to get tenure. And so standards go up and opportunities go down, you know, that kind of thing.
So you're doing primarily research in the 70s.
Yes, yeah. Throughout the 70s, as I said, I was more interested in doing research than I was, as I mentioned earlier, being a bureaucrat, maintaining the center on a status quo basis. And in 1983, I think it was, I decided to resign as director of the center. It had caused me much grief. I had become rather depressed by the fact that I was not able to, in a sense, ratchet myself up or to pour more energy into the center, because I was drained by then. And I just am sorry that I didn't resign as director of the center earlier. It would have been better for me, and I think better for the center. But one has to experience this to really understand one's motivation. But during this time, I was teaching courses in the department. As I said, I still had a half-time appointment, and I would teach one course a semester. I instituted a course on the history of the American film industry. And ultimately, the course evolved into a two-semester sequence. But during the 1970s, I inaugurated this course around the time when I published my American Film Industry book. So this became my text and became the basis for a course, which is still being taught at the university.
I suspect that was a popular course.
Yes, it was, yes.
And you enjoyed teaching?
Oh, yes. I enjoyed it a lot because I was learning along with my students. The book, was just an introduction to the history of Hollywood. And by teaching this course and having graduate students in it, and also being able to teach graduate seminars, I learned a lot. And I was never really, yes, I was the instructor of record, but I always thought of myself as a cold learner with my students. Obviously, I knew more than the undergraduates, but I always enjoyed working with the graduate students because it was very exciting just to do research and opening up the field and discovering things that had not been known before. And I had enjoyed that immensely.
And is that the course that you were bringing back UW alumni who had had careers in Hollywood?
That is correct. A couple years ago I did this, and this was when the course was a part of a two-semester sequence, and yes, the course that I offered was part two of my original course that focused on the contemporary film industry. By contemporary, I mean from 1948 to the present, the modern film industry, as opposed to the classical Hollywood film industry of the 20s and 30s and 40s.
And there, I think it's fair to say that there's a disproportionately large number of UW alumni in Hollywood than what you might think would be the case.
You're right, yes, yes. Many of them graduated from the university in the 60s and 70s. Some of them did take courses from me, but oddly enough, most of the prominent alums in the entertainment industry did not graduate from our department. In a sense, they've matured as students here before. Film and television was regularized as an academic study.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
So, Tino, talk now about some of the dynamics of the department and the
right.
growth and the evolution
yeah. right.
and the problems in the department.
Yes. Well, there were some significant problems in the late 70s and the early 80s. Again, they reflected similar problems that theater and drama had endured, because in any umbrella department there's going to be competition for resources. And by that I mean specifically, not so much competition for budgets, but competition for new faculty lines. And that's where most of the energy of academics goes to expand one's field. This is the argument that deans hear day in and day out. A department chair will go to the dean and say, we need somebody to cover this subject area in English history or something. We need somebody to cover Middle Eastern history. Or if there's a chair representing film, the chair will say, we need somebody to cover early silent film in order to plug this gap in our discipline. So it's not difficult to understand when you have a new field like film that's growing, that it eventually becomes an identifiable discipline.
Mm-hmm.
The people working in the field have identified the field as consisting of this kind of subject material, this area, or this national film industry. What happened? Anyway, things become solidified. So, if you're an academic working within a department, you feel like in order to teach your students appropriately, or your graduate students in particular appropriately, you need to have the faculty to cover all the important bases that constitute your field. Now, in order to do this, you have to hire people.
Yeah.
So, in a period when the university is not growing, or is somewhat stagnant, competition for new job lines is enormous, within departments and among departments within colleges throughout the university. The new job line is the lingua franca of academia. So, within a department, that if you have like a burgeoning film program, and we were very good, and still are. But I was very prominent in the field. David Bordwell was even more prominent in the field than I was. He, in a sense, helped to define many areas of the field and really developed a major reputation for himself. But because we had been publishing a lot, David was, and still is, a prodigious publisher, because I was publishing, because my colleagues in the film were publishing, we felt like that we had first claim on new faculty lines. There was another area of the department that was the traditional leader of the department by virtue of its age, and this was the rhetoric area, this area felt that it had to maintain its area along traditional lines.
Mm-hmm.
And here you have conflict when you force a reallocation of resources. This is very difficult for a university to do, because when you have people who are tenured, they have the job for life. But when opportunities arise to get a new line, there's a tremendous amount of competition to acquire this line, to buttress one's own field. So you can easily see why there'd be a political battle among the faculty. If one part of the faculty perceives that the other part of the faculty or another area of the faculty, if we're not being productive, then the part of the faculty that's in a growth mode feels like it deserves the new faculty line. And there are other manifestations of this conflict. If people feel like an area is not pulling its weight, or if the faculty, the new or the younger faculty, are not as strong as other faculty members, it's because one more difficult for that person to be given tenure. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of this in our department. And ultimately it led for a period of time to the demise, the near demise of rhetoric, and to the growth of film and television studies within the department. Mm-hmm. Things have changed somewhat in the past half a dozen years, but nonetheless, these were growing pains in the department during the 70s and 80s.
Growing pains to the point that it was unpleasant?
Yes, there was a time that was very unpleasant. We were, extremely so. I think that beginning of in the early 90s, it quieted down significantly. And people were quite happy just as things were, and there was very little infighting, and the department stabilized, and it was a very pleasant place to work in.
Now, you were chair of the department.
Yes.
Tino.
Yes.
Were you chair during this difficult time?
No, I was not. I was not chair. I had no administrative responsibility during this time.
Who was chair then?
Lloyd Bitzer. Well, Ed Black was, and then Lloyd Bitzer. And then Joe Capella were the chairs of the department during this time. And the fact that they were either in rhetoric or communications reflected the history of the department, because most of the academic leadership in the department came from the more entrenched and the more traditional side of the department. And these people had always just assumed that they would be chairs of the department. And it wasn't until Vance Kepling was made chair of the department that a person outside of rhetoric or communications was able to chair the department and to provide some leadership.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a major shift as well. I became chair of the department after serving for several years as the associate chair. I think I was chair of the department for 4 years. And Vance Cutley is now chair of the department as well. And one of the problems that film faced during the 1990s was the fact that it had prominent professors in its midst, and these professors were doing a lot of administrative work for the university or for the department. I, in particular, served as chair of the department for 4 years. Prior to that, I served as associate chair for about 3 years in the department. Then I became chair of the Arts Consortium, then the executive director of the Arts Institute. And as a result of these administrative appointments, my work as a professor within the department changed dramatically. I was spending less time teaching, less time directing graduate students because of these other administrative appointments. David Bordwell, similarly, was appointed director of the center and on many other committees and so forth, and he too was drawn away from his work as an academic within the department. So the more experience you get, the more are being tapped by the university to do different things.
And we will be addressing the issue of university service,
right.
But related to your standing in the department, you and David Bordwell in particular had an increasingly visible
presence on campus.
Yes.
And that had to affect the power of film within the department.
Absolutely, yes, right, right. Yes, I began to become more involved in university service when I became a member of the Humanities Divisional Committee, and I was chair of the Humanities Divisional Committee. And that appointment, elected to that position, changed my reputation. I mean, had an effect on my reputation as an academic at the university. And
how did it change it, Tim?
Well, it made me a player, you might say, within the university. It's one thing to be a chair of your department, but to be chair of a divisional committee, first of all, signifies that you're being that you are respected by your colleagues in your field throughout the university. And secondly, you know, this is being a chair or being a member of a divisional committee is one of the most important committees on campus, because there you are making significant decisions affecting the careers of your colleagues within your own field. And it's, to me, it's one of the most satisfying committees I ever served on, because you were asked to evaluate the professional competence of people coming up for tenure. And these were key decisions. Many decisions you make on university committees are ephemeral, unimportant, you know. So, but decisions you make as a member of the divisional committee are extremely important, because you're essentially giving a person tenure.
That's the that's the essential purpose of the divisional committee?
Yes. That is its main purpose, to review the documents a department has presented in making a case to give a junior professor tenure. The divisional committee reviews the documents and votes up or down whether or not to offer this person to make recommendation to the dean to give this person tenure.
So you really are, you are the decision-making body, except for the dean saying yes or no.
That's right, that's right.
Was that difficult? Did the divisional committee often or occasionally reject the department recommendations?
On occasion it did. Normally departments would do their work and not propose anybody for tenure who didn't have a strong case. It was only when the department was remiss in sending up somebody who clearly wasn't qualified, or maybe submitted somebody up for consideration early, that we rejected the case. But if the department does its work, what the committee does is to keep departments honest by reviewing the qualifications of the candidate to make sure that they measure up to university standards.
Okay, so this is 1990 through 1993.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And you were chair. What did you have to do as chair, Tino?
Well,
of the divisional committee.
Well, as chair of the divisional committee, well, you make the assignments as the cases come up for consideration. You assign the cases to individual members of the divisional committee, and you ensure that the deliberations, I mean, you don't have any specific responsibilities, but you ensure that the deliberations are conducted in an appropriate manner. The divisional committee constantly gets new members. People serve staggered terms, so there's always new people who come on board, so you have to make certain that they are acculturated appropriately, so that when they become part of the deliberative process, they're whistling the same tune as the rest of the committee. It's difficult to state concretely what the chair does, other than just to chair the meeting, as any chair would. But beyond that, to make certain that there's a continuation of an appropriate way to deal, to handle issues, so that the candidates and the departments are treated fairly, and to make certain that standards are upheld, and that people whose careers you are being evaluated are treated fairly.
Tino, if the department recommends someone for tenure and the divisional committee recommends that person for tenure, does it ever happen that the dean will turn both of those down?
I'm sure it must have happened at some point in history, but it's unusual. I mean, it would be highly unusual to do this. Now, there are cases, there have been cases when the divisional committee has turned down a case, and then the department will appeal the decision, and that, which means that the divisional committee has to re-review the case and so forth. But typically, if the divisional committee votes approval, then the dean automatically accepts the recommendation.
Uh-huh. This divisional committee, which I hear about from a number of my subjects, mm-hmm. Is this really a subset of faculty governance?
Absolutely. It's probably the most important subset of academic governance. Because for a dean not to accept the recommendation, the positive recommendation of the divisional committee would really cause some problems.
Mm-hmm. Generally, has faculty governance worked well for the UW?
Well, I think you have to be very specific about how you evaluate this. I think that, as I said, the divisional committee is one of the most important faculty governance committees around. The faculty governance does not have any direct control over the budget. So I think that faculty governance is important for the faculty to enable members of the faculty to have a say in the decision-making process. But it's not true faculty governance in the sense that faculty committees can actually have an impact on how budgets are allocated.
Mm-hmm.
But the faculty governance procedures are important in maintaining the curriculum and maintaining the changes that take place within the curriculum and the entire educational goal of the university. Because what for example, the divisional committees not only deal with personnel and tenure matters, but they also deal with new courses. They approve new courses or new course changes. The various committees of the university review academic programs or review the reviews of academic programs, or certain committees review the graduate programs of departments and make recommendations to the appropriate dean, so forth and so on. So there's a lot of faculty oversight of the academics of the university.
Mm-hmm.
And this this to me is one of the strengths of the University of Wisconsin, because nobody could ever say this is a top-down university.
Uh-huh.
In essence it is, but the point I'm making is that the faculty has opportunities to have a voice, to state it very clearly over time, so that even though onerous decisions have to be made, I think the faculty understands that, it has a better understanding of why some of these decisions are being made, and doesn't feel being cut off from the decision-making process. The administrators of the university spend a considerable amount of time sitting in on committees, just to talk things through, and to pass on recommendations and so forth and so on.
And you think that this process has contributed to the intellectual strength of the university?
It may do all of that, but it also makes the faculty feel that they're a part of the university in ways that they wouldn't feel before. There is a tremendous centrifugal force, if that's my term, that exists within a major research university, because it's very easy to feel more aligned, A, to your department or to your field or to your research than it is to your home institution. And it varies depending upon what field you're in. But there are these forces that in a sense make you have stronger allegiances to, as I say, to your field, to things outside of your home institution. So anything that can strengthen a faculty's relationship to the home institution, I think benefits the home institution.
Tino, I want to ask you now about your role in the arts community in general, in the university.
The discussion on arts will continue on November 30th, 2005. This concludes tape 3.